Well, pop yourself a beer or a cold libation. Let me tell you about the sax little thing. I heard the latest show from Brother Jason, and he's gonna put a coda on the thing. I asked if it was dead like Walsh or Gossett, and I'm sending Gary G. Ward. He said, "Don't give up hope, but I'm just a little tired, and I know that I can take him at his word. And if there's a silver lining to my brother's latest handbook, I'd have to think it goes something like this. When it comes to gaming episode and turning out new episodes, playing at the table that we'll miss. The Nerds Variety Podcast. Nerds RPG Podcast. The Nerds Variety Podcast. The Nerds RPG."
Hey everybody, before we get into it, I just want to mention that this is an older recording. We recorded this at the beginning of the year, and unfortunately there was a lot of technical problems with this recording. There was lag and some audio issues, and we meant to re-record this episode, and we never got around to it. Fate just got in the way, and we weren't able to get our schedules together to actually re-record the episode in time. So I've cleaned it up the best I can. I think it's serviceable. I think it's good enough. And I hope you enjoy it. But I did want to let you know ahead of time about slight audio issues in this episode, and let you know that, you know, it wasn't through lack of desire that we didn't re-record the episode. It just wasn't in the cards. But I definitely wanted to get this out in some shape or form, this wonderful talk with my buddy Joe, prior to the end of the show. So, enjoy. Welcome back to another episode of Nerds RPG Variety Cast. This is another in our series on the Walter Hill film retrospective for 2024. Today, I've got Joe from Hindsightless with me, and we're going to talk about 1985's Brewster's Millions. How are you doing, Joe?
I'm really good, man. I'm so happy that I watched this movie again. I'm excited to talk about it.
I am too, you know, and I'm kind of sad because, well, really quickly, folks, full spoilers for this movie. It says that in the show notes, but I just want to reiterate it. I mean, it's a comedy. I don't think there's not really like super twists in the movie or anything. It is what it says on the tin. Like if you read the blurb, you know what happens.
Yes.
But that said, I highly recommend you watch the movie, then listen to this. I think Joe would agree. We both give this three thumbs up. I mean, it's a great movie.
Big time.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I'm kind of sad because I don't own this on physical media, and I rented it.
Me neither.
But I kind of wish I had bought it. Or actually what I'm going to do is after this recording, I'm going to get Amazon has some of the Shout Factory Blu-rays. And the Shout Factory Blu-ray also has an audio commentary, but it also has a copy of the 1945 Brewster's Millions. I'm going to talk about that in a little bit on the Blu-ray.
Nice.
So I'm probably going to buy that because I watched both of those, and I'll talk about that here in a minute. But
yeah, sweet, yeah. Man.
Yeah. So I get before we get into anything else, when's the first time you remember seeing this?
It would have, so this movie came out in 85, you said? Uh-huh. Probably, yep. 86, 87, maybe. I'm pretty sure I don't think I saw it in the theaters, but on HBO probably in like 86 or something, or rented it from Video Safari.
Yeah, that same here. I didn't see it in the theater, but I'm sure I saw it on cable, you know, on HBO or like say from the video store. Definitely saw it in high school. Definitely saw it back then. In the 80s.
I was like 8, 9, 10 years old when I first saw this movie, like first started watching Richard Pryor movies.
Yeah.
That says a lot about me.
Well, yeah, because this is
Richard Pryor rules.
Let's be frank here. This is one of the really sanitized Richard Pryor movies, right?
Absolutely. Yeah.
Yeah. Because when you look at, I mean, this show isn't about Richard Pryor. It's about the movie. But Richard Pryor did obviously tons of stuff. Amazing comedian. Sadly died too soon. You know, he had a number of personal issues between drugs and health things and other stuff, right? it's just a shame, you know, because like he dealt with like multiple sclerosis, he had some heart issues, some other stuff going on, right? But, you know, amazing comedian, and he really revolutionized the comedy thing, not by himself. There are other comedians out there doing like the more crass stuff and using language and talking about real situations and all that kind of thing. But he is one of the ones that really started getting it more in the public view, I guess would be a better way to say it, from out of that, just the nightclubs and comedy clubs, more into the public view. Richard Pryor is one of the ones that kind of broke through from that background into the mainstream with a more colorful language and all that kind of thing. Right. Like we can't even realistically, yeah, like you and I can't really even say some of the tracks he had and some of the albums he had and stuff like that. Right. You know,
right.
I mean, we can say it, but honestly, it's not things white men should be saying. Right. It's, but
yes, but that's, yes, for sure. Yeah,
but that's all comedy gold. And it came from a place of realism, which you know, mm-hmm, all comedy has, you know, should have that kernel of realism to help it out. Yeah, taken from us way too soon. Richard Pryor's great, but this is one of the ones, he's in a number of things throughout his life that were tried to be more presentable to the public. Like this, Superman 3, The Toy, not all the movies he did with Gene Wilder, but some of the ones with Gene Wilder are a little bit tamer.
Yeah. But,
Yeah, but yeah, amazing comedian. I'm a huge fan of Richard Pryor. Always have been ever since I first, you know, came across him. And yeah, it's well worth checking all of this stuff out.
For sure. Yeah.
So now the other person that gets co-billing in this movie, of course, is, mm-hmm, John Candy.
Mm-hmm.
And John Candy's another, you know, actor taken from us too soon, right? And John Candy's another one I really enjoy. Apparently, though, Richard Pryor didn't like John Candy. And that's why we never really saw them again. And if you notice, Candy's part in this movie, I won't say it's cut back, but he's not in the movie as much as you'd think he'd be in the movie. Really. He's kind
of right. And I wouldn't say their chemistry is, I, you know, it's not solid gold.
Right.
Their chemistry in this movie. They both play awesome characters. Mm-hmm. But like together as friends, you know, you buy it. I buy it, but not like super buy it.
Right. Yeah. Well, that's like Lynette McKee, who plays Angela Drake, who plays the accountant assigned to him. You know, she's in the movie more than John Candy is. Really?
Yeah. Yeah. And she's awesome. She does a great job. She's fantastic.
She was a singer, I want to say. Yeah. Cause she was in like Hot Club, and she was an actress too. I mean, she was in, you know, a number of films, but I think she was mostly in the music business. So this is directed by Walter Hill. This is really the only straight comedy, like pure comedy, that Walter Hill directed. Interesting enough. I mean, there's comedy in his other stuff, but this one, you know, is his only true straight up comedy.
Right.
It was, you know, it was written initially by the writers of Trading Places, which is a movie that might come up later. Who knows?
Mm-hmm.
And interestingly enough, you know, Richard Pryor was not the first pick for this. They were looking at other people, you know, John Ritter was somebody they were thinking about, which would have been an interesting choice. Bill Murray. Definitely a different movie with John Ritter or Bill Murray in there, right?
A completely different movie, yeah.
Yeah, but I'm glad they ended up going with Richard Pryor. I really am. This is a movie, I really enjoyed it. And when I rewatched it before we started recording, and you know, this is a movie I can come back to every few years and watch and still laugh at it and really enjoy it. And I think there's a good message in here too. So, but
I think there's a ton of good messages in this movie.
That's true. That's right. None of the above, right? But
mm-hmm.
I mean, if anything, this is just as topical now or more so than it was in the 85.
When I was watching it last night, I was like, dang, this is hitting too close, man.
That's right.
It's so good. It's still so relevant. Like, that just goes to show, like, nothing changes, man. But it's so good. So it's an hour and 41 minutes long or something. So it's under the 2-hour mark, which is nice. And it moves. I never felt bored at all. Like it moves. And it's just so good.
Yeah. So the running time is 101 minutes. So it's just over an hour and a half. And I don't think it drags at any point. I think it keeps, I think it's got a good pace to it. This is based, I guess we should give a quick background for anybody that doesn't know. This is based on a 1902 novel by George McCutcheon. And it's been made into a number of different movies in 1914, 1921, 1935, 1945. They made this one. They made one called Mrs. Brewster's Millions with a female protagonist in 1926. There's a British version. There's a Bollywood version of this. There's tons of different adaptations of this movie. The Mrs. Brewster's is interesting.
You know, it would be.
Yo, go ahead. Go ahead, Joe.
Oh, I was going to say. Yeah, I was going to say what would be interesting, a fun research project, is to go through and see the different amounts of money he's offered throughout the different years. Because I can't imagine in the 1902 version, it's $30 million.
Right. Yeah, no, it's not actually. It's so I didn't go through every single one, but in the 1902 version, it's $7 million and he has to spend $1 million up front.
Mm-hmm.
In the Mrs. Brewster's Millions, right, where we have Baby Daniels as our protagonist, Polly Brewster, she has to spend $1 million to get $5 million. Although that has a twist at the end that her uncle turned out to be penniless and there's no money to be inherited at the end of the movie. But she had made an investment in a motion picture company. And anyway, it turns out okay for her. Nice. Unfortunately, that's a lost film. There aren't any cop. That's one of the lost films from that era. And we, you know, there are copies that survived. In the 1945 version, it's $1 million and he has to spend $1 million up front. Of course, in this one, it's $300 million, but he has to spend $30 million in a month.
Yeah.
Yeah. And in fact, in the 45 version, he has 2 months to spend $1 million. 2 months to spend $1 million is the way that one works out. Okay. The 45 version is interesting. And like I said, I'm glad there's a copy on the tape. I enjoy it. So the 45 version, real quickly, is he's a soldier. He's coming back from World War II with a couple of his buddies. He's supposed to be getting married. And so, you know, his buddies end up getting hired on the firm as he's spending the money and all this. But there's a marriage clause where he can't get married while he's spending the money in the 45 version. So you have the added complication that he's engaged, but he can't tell his fiance what's going on, but he's blowing all this money and doing all this stuff. One of the things he invests in is a play on Broadway, a Broadway play, which is a great way to blow money. But obviously the actresses in the play and stuff are kissing up to him. So that causes romantic tension and all. So it's actually pretty well done. And the actor, the main actor in that, Dennis O'Keefe, does a really good job showing the pressure he's under, like the mental pressure and stress he's under from trying to do it. The main reason the 45 is really interesting, though, to me is because it has Eddie Anderson in there. He plays a famous African-American actor. He plays Jackson, who's the family servant for his fiance's family. But he's treated. So if you think of the Fresh Prince of Bel-Air, right? And we think of Jeffrey and the Fresh Prince of Bel-Air. Yeah, he's their butler, but he's not treated so much as a servant, right? Like they listen to him and they treat him with respect and all that. The Banks is kind of treat him as one of them. Yeah, he's a servant. He works for him, but he's not treated like shit, right? Well, in the 45 Brewster's Millions, the relationship between everybody in the movie and Jackson is basically that same relationship with Jeffrey in Fresh Prince of Bel-Air. Yes, he's a servant, but he's not treated bad. His suggestions are treated respectfully. You know, he's treated respectfully. And the reason that's important is the whole reason we had to have the civil rights happen, because that movie was banned in Memphis, Tennessee, under the grounds it was inimical to public welfare because he was treated too nicely by the white characters and it was going to cause racial problems in Tennessee if they showed this 1945 movie. Isn't that crazy?
Yeah, man. That's just wild, dude.
Yeah, it's
that's nuts. Absolutely wild.
Yeah. It's an interesting movie. It's a good adaptation of this. I
if somebody wants to watch another, like Brewster's Millions, another version of the story, I can recommend the 45 version. It's pretty good. And it's interesting to watch because, I mean, obviously he's still the servant, but to watch that and think that movie was banned in Tennessee because of race relations is in the 1940s, you know, after World War II, you know.
Yeah. That the 40s weren't even all that long ago when you really think about it either.
Right. Well, that's
like
why
when you really think about it,
you know?
Yeah.
So
it's crazy.
Yeah. So we start off. So let's talk about this movie, though, the 1985 one that we watched here.
Yeah.
So our major character here, of course, is Monty Brewster, Montgomery Brewster, played by Richard Pryor. And he's a pitcher for a minor league baseball team, the Hackensack Bulls. And he had played for some major league teams for a little bit. He played for the Cubs, he said.
He says whether or not that's true, that's
right. But
maybe.
but he has played. We do find out, you know, a little bit later when the manager comes to talk him in jail. He's been a professional baseball player, maybe a minor league one, but for a number of years. So
yeah, 15 years. That's a long time. Right.
Yeah, it definitely. Our major characters, him and then his buddy, who's the catcher on the team, Spike Nolan, played by John Candy. So we open up with a ball game, this minor league ball game, and they're playing the Camden. I don't even know what the other team is, but they're from Camden, New Jersey. And they're, you know, it's great because you get them pitching. John Candy's giving all the batters crap, you know, talking smack to them, and which is fun.
It's so good, dude. He's so good at it.
Yeah, and you know, and they have to stop the game because there's a train tracks through the field and train runs through the outfield. And it's great. And I have to ask you, Joe, am I the only one that would be happy with a movie just about the Bulls with Monty and Spike playing on the team with the train going through that outfield with John Candy there in the bar opening beer bottles with his teeth, hitting on the ladies who are the girls of the other team?
Mm-hmm.
You know, I can do with this, a movie just about that minor league baseball team.
I would 100% watch that. I'd 1,000% watch that game. So would you consider Brewster's Millions a baseball movie?
Yeah, I would, because baseball is pretty central to this.
It's pretty central, right? Yeah. Like, it never gets mentioned as a baseball movie, but watching it again, baseball is a major plot point in the whole movie, like from start to finish.
No, that's a good call. I don't remember if anybody mentioned it back when we did the contest for sports movies, but yeah, this definitely belongs there because it's not just the beginning of the movie, but you know, he arranges this game with the Yankees and they play the Yankees and they show that it's, you know, John Candy does the same thing to the Yankees batters. He talks smack about their wives.
Oh, dude, that when he's talking to Dixon about seeing the guy on the Yankees, about seeing him on TV, he's like, yeah, I saw your wife on TV too. She's an ugly bitch, isn't she, dude? I lost it, man. I laughed so loud just in my room, probably sounding like a lunatic to my roommate. But that, I just died when he said that, man. I was like, dude, Candy, you rule.
Yeah. And then the next guy that comes up, he goes, you know, he couldn't get over on him. You know, he's like, have you seen his wife? He goes, yeah, she's an ugly bitch. And
she's ugly. Oh, it's so good, man.
No, but it's great. Now, the name of that bar is Torchy's. That's, or at least in this movie it is. And that's the same name they use for the bar in Streets of Fire. This is also the bar that we're going to see again. Well, we're going to see, we've already seen, I should say, these shows are recorded out of order, folks, but in 48 hours, this is the bar in 48 hours.
So is this the same universe then?
Maybe. I can see that.
Is it a Yeah. Does 48 hours take place in the Brewster's Millions universe and vice versa?
You know, I don't think there's anything that would contradict that.
Yeah.
Now, I don't think there's any reason they couldn't. I mean, you got dirty politicians, so it's not like this isn't like a happy-go-lucky universe by any means. It's the real
world. Oh, yeah, not at all. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I could see that. I could definitely see this being in the same universe. Yeah. That's interesting because some of Walter Hill's movies, you know, it's his retrospective, right? So Streets of Fire and The Warriors are definitely in different, slightly different realities than ours, right?
Right.
But this, I could see this and Red Heat and 48 Hours. I could see 48 all the
hours.
Same universe.
Yeah, for sure. Nice.
No, that's a good question. Yeah. Interesting.
Shared universe. Well, when you mentioned that the bar all has the same, he couldn't have done that on accident.
Oh, no. Yeah. 48 Hours. Let me think. Streets of Fire was 80. I don't remember now. Of course, I talked about that in December with Anthony over at Runeslinger, but Streets of Fire is 84. It's the year before this. So, yeah, it can't be an accident.
Right.
Yeah, they must have done that on purpose. You know, I haven't researched this. Waterhill probably knew of a bar called Torchy's, and that's why, you know, he's naming numerous bars Torchy's.
Yeah, probably.
Yeah. So I guess that's a good time to bring up. We're going to go through the movie, kind of plot points to talk about it. But I guess just overall, you know, when we talk about the sets, I think the sets are all really good here. They did shoot a lot in New York, you know, a lot at one location. And some of these are sets, right? Obviously, like the penthouse is going to be a set.
Right. Mm-hmm.
But I think they all look pretty good. I think all the camera work and the sets and the, you know, the costuming and all that, I think, you know, it's all good to go. I didn't see anything that really stood out or looked like crap or anything like that. Did you?
No, me neither. It felt like New York to me.
Yeah. Ry Cooter did the music for this. He does a lot music for a lot of the Waterhill things. Like he did Southern Comfort. He did some other things. The music was fine. There are some songs in here. Yeah. For the most part, it kind of was just in the background, though. It didn't grab my attention. You know, I can't think of anything with it. There was music there, but it didn't interrupt the movie, but it didn't really leave a big impression on me either, to be honest.
Yeah.
Yeah. So anyway, we open up with this ball game and there's this seedy looking guy in the stands taking pictures. So Monty thinks this is a scout who's going to get him in the big leagues, which is why, yeah, maybe he wasn't in the big leagues, but anyway, this guy's taking pictures and he's convinced it's a scout. And Spike tells him, you know, look, there's a train going through the outfield. Nobody's scouting us. We're in Hackensack, New Jersey. So after the game, and I love the way they win that game with that final strike. Cause you know, and Spike tells him, you know, I'll get you drunk after the game if you strike this guy out. And he fakes him out. He throws this good. And of course, Spike is, the catcher's giving him crap the whole time, and this batter's really frustrated. And then he does this outrageous, just really high pitch. But the batter was, because he pissed off, he swung anyway, struck out. I don't know why that strikes me as funny.
You know what? Yeah. I couldn't remember if he got that guy, if he struck him out or not. I was nervous for that. I was like, does he get him? I can't remember. Yeah. So I thought it's really well set up. It was tense, man. There were some stakes on. A free night of drinking.
Yep.
That's a great scene.
Yeah. So then they go to the bar and they're in the bar. I actually love this bar scene. I already kind of mentioned John Candy's opening beer bottles. He's taking the caps off with his teeth. But they're trying to impress these two ladies. And we saw these ladies in the stands before and they had the Camden shirts on. So they had the other team shirts on. And they were yelling crap to Monty during the game. You know, they're hitting on them and they were getting somewhere with them. You know, and they had some interesting lines in there, you know, some good pickup lines in there. You know, talk about massaging and how nude massage is better.
The energy. Yeah. You need the energy. It can't go through clothes.
Right.
That's smooth, man. That's smooth.
And they're walking out of the bar and the other team comes in and they happen to be the fiancés. And these guys are assholes, you know, and they're mean to the ladies. Threatening the ladies and being violent with the, you know, being physically, you know, like grabbing these ladies harsh and something. Anyway, but there ends up being a bar fight, and the only people get thrown in jail are Spike and Monty. And
what happened to everybody else?
Right.
I was just like, what happened to everybody else, man?
Well, I'm pretty sure they're in Camden is where they're playing. They're not in Hackensack. I think, well, no, he said they were in Hackensack. Anyway, I guess.
No, they're in, yeah.
But either way, they're the only one. They're the only two that get thrown in jail. But Spike, you know, who's played by John Candy, affirms to Monty, you know, well, it's not racial because I'm in jail with you too.
Oh, it's too good, dude.
Yeah, but they go in front of the judge, and now we're not going to hit necessarily everybody in this movie, right? But there are tons of character actors in the movie, ton of actors in this movie that you've seen in other things, right? And you know, the judge is no different. She's the mother on Family Matters. So anybody that's watched Family Matters is going to recognize her. It's Rosetta Lenore.
I knew I recognized her.
Yeah, I mean, she's been in tons of stuff over the years, but I think that's what that's the most recognizable thing nowadays.
Mm-hmm.
But she was also in like Give Me a Break, Amen. She's been in a bunch of stuff. But anyway, but she's a judge and she's not having any of it. They try to fast talk their way out. And Monty really quickly realizes Spike's getting him in trouble.
Yep.
And Monty's like, I'm not with him.
Yeah. It's fantastic. I wonder how much of their lines were scripted and how much they were kind of going off the cuff with some of that stuff.
Yeah. I don't know like I say, I didn't get to, you know, hear any kind of director commentary or anything for this. And there aren't any making of videos on YouTube that I could find. So I mean, I've read some notes and some background stuff, but I don't know the answer to that.
Yeah, because it feels like it's just coming off the cuff, you know, and it feels it feels real. It's awesome.
Yeah, and Waterhill may have just let them do that, just go and see what worked, you know. I'm not sure. But effectively, they end up getting, you know, they're going to get thrown in jail. They're going to get the book thrown at them because they don't have money for bond or anything. But this shady guy who's been following him around pops up, and this is you remember what his name was? Because I don't have it. Where is it?
No.
Okay, so it's JB,
the photographer guy.
Yeah. JB Donilo was the guy that was following him around, and he stands up and he says, you know, I can't tell you who I work for, but I've been given permission to bail these guys out and pay their legal fees if their fines, if they plead guilty, which I'm sure they're going to do now. And you know, they do plead guilty. Now, he's another character actor we've seen. He's played by Joe Grafassi, and he's been in tons and tons of stuff. I mean, I don't even know what the most recognizable thing for him. He was in this. I mean, you've seen him because he was in like Batman, Tim Burton's Batman. He's been in tons.
Okay.
Yeah. But
yeah, he feels like an 80s staple, you know. He feels like a guy that you've seen in other movies before. Oh, yeah. Sure.
He was in Splash. He was in FX. He was in Moonstruck. He's been in a bunch of stuff, right?
Yeah. He feels like that.
Yeah. But anyway, so we've got him. Or you know what? I thought he was in Batman, but it's not showing Batman on the thing. So maybe I had him confused. Anyway, but he's been in a bunch of stuff. We've seen him before. But he gets him in the car and he's taking him to New York. And Monty keeps talking about how, you know, we're going to go. It's the Mets. We're, you know, and he never says he's a talent scout. And, you know.
Right.
They get to this big building, office building, and they're going up. And Spike goes and looks at the thing that has where all, you know, the directory with all the businesses in the building, in the offices, and the Mets aren't there. He's like, hey, the Mets aren't here. This is a trick. He goes, no. You know, I never said I was from the Mets. But anyway, they go up to this law office, and Monty's taken a room alone, and he's told that he's inherited all this money from this long-lost relative he didn't know he had. But, you know, there's a catch. To inherit the $300 million, he's got to spend $30 million in 30 days. And there's a fun little scene where his uncle, you know, they have a video of his uncle and they're playing it. And, you know, Hume Cronin plays him. Maybe Hume Cronin's most recognizable from Cocoon, maybe. He's been in a bunch of stuff. Cocoon, I think I'm in. Batteries Not Included, I think I'm in. He was in The Pelican Brief. People remember that movie. He's been in
a bunch. Okay. Yeah.
But maybe Cocoon is the one.
He's great.
Yeah. Oh, he's great in this. Yeah.
He's a
He's so good, dude. That story he tells about his dad locking him in the coat closet for 3 days because he caught him smoking with nothing but a pack of cigars and a pack of matches.
Yep.
Oh, dude, it's so good.
Yeah, it is. And of course, now there are some rules. So the rules are that. So now this has an option, a couple things that weren't in the 45 one. So in this one, mm-hmm. he has to spend 30 millions in 30 days to inherit the full 300 million, or he has a wimp cause where he can just take $1 million and go and leave it, which he doesn't choose to do. He can't have any assets at the end of the 30 days. He can only have the shirt on his back. So he can't buy and he's also not allowed to destroy assets. So he can't buy expensive paintings and just rip them up. That'll come up. We'll talk about that.
Yeah, for sure.
He can only donate 5% to charity, and he can only gamble 5%. He can't give money away, but he can hire people. But he has to get some service for.
Yeah, he's got to get value for his money.
Right, and then he can't tell anybody about the stipulations that he has to spend this 30 million in 30 days.
So the only reason. The only reason that stipulation is in there is because, as his uncle tells him, he didn't have any friends growing up, so he wants Monty not to have any friends.
Right, yeah, nobody can help him, you know, because friends can help him. Yeah,
nobody helped me with all those cigars.
Yeah. Yeah, and so in the 45 version, it was kind of the same story. He had but it was chewing tobacco. He had,
okay.
His dad made him do chewing tobacco.
Oh.
Yeah, so same kind of thing. But yeah, so these are stipulations. And then we meet three guys here. They're in this room with him. There's the one guy, Edward Roundfield, is played by Pat Hingle. And people are going to recognize Pat Hingle. Maybe, again, we talk about Batman. He was Commissioner Gordon in those Batman movies. I mean, he's in tons and tons of stuff. But, you know, that's maybe where you think of him. And then there are two. So Roundfield is the executor of the will. And then there are two lawyers in there. And the lawyers kind of have been handling the money for his uncle. Well, so to cut to the chase, the lawyers get the money if Monty screws up. If Monty can't spend it in time, the lawyers get the money. And they're supposed to give it to charitable causes, but they get to take a huge cut as their fees. So what happens is the lawyers try to sabotage Monty throughout the movie. And they attach an accountant to him to make sure he has all the receipts and all that stuff. The accountant, we've already mentioned, Angela Drake, played by McKee. And so she's attached to him to get all the receipts. And then later on, they have her fiance spy on him and try to sabotage it because they want to get a hold of that money. And that'll come up.
Yeah, the fiance. Yeah, we'll talk more about him, too.
Yeah, but so those are the ground rules. And so Monty decides, no, he's going to go for it. And, you know, he starts right away, you know, as they walk out, you know, they say, well, you want to go to the bank, right? And see the money. He goes, yeah, I want to see the money. And so he goes out there and immediately he hires JB. I think maybe his name was Jake. They called him Jake. But anyway, he hires him to be his photographer, you know, like for $10,000 a week or something like that, right?
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, they go across the street. They see the money and they've got the money in there in pallets of $100 bills, you know, three pallets, I guess, $10,000, $10 million each in the bank.
That's okay. When they open up the bank vault and there's just $30 million in cash sitting there. I was like, that's not how bank works, but I love it, dude.
Well, they said
it looks so good.
I can go with that because they had set up the money for him to see it, right? So where it normally wouldn't be there. I could believe it was a special, you know, they specially set it up. But anyway, so he comes out and he basically hires all the bank guards in there. He goes, what are they paying you? I'll pay you $10,000 a week to be my head of security. You know, and he hires all them so they can go around with him with the money to keep him safe. He goes out, he hires a cab driver played by Yakov Smirnoff, who anybody.
Yakov Smirnoff, dude, I was stoked to see Yakov, man. That was awesome that he was in. He's like, what a country.
Yeah. I mean, that does that never, all his stuff, right? But yeah, so he's in there. He hires him to be his cab driver and tells him to go get some limos and stuff. he tells everybody on the street, you know, lunch is on him, and they go and they have lunch, and he's blowing money as best he can. I get, like I say, we're not going to go beat by beat, but he ends up going to the Plaza Hotel, and he rents the top half of the Plaza Hotel for $1 million for the month. And he says he's going to open his business the next day, and his business is going to be helping inventors and entrepreneurs and stuff. You know, people are turned down before. And that must be in the book, because that's in the 45 movie, too. They do that same kind of thing in the 1945
okay.
movie with like weird inventions and stuff. So that's kind of the deal. And then I don't know. I don't know how much we want to, where do you want to go from here? Do we want to jump ahead to the fiance?
Well, yeah. So yeah, we can jump ahead. Like a lot of the movie is just him spending money in crazy ways, right? Crazy, yeah. Hilarious, yeah. Awesome ways. Yeah. So we can jump ahead a little bit.
So obviously he's trying to, you know, he's attracted to this accountant and he's trying to at least be friendly with her, and she's really cold and not warming up to him at all. And he's like, oh, I want to meet your fiance. And she goes, oh, you know, he's a good man. And he goes to charities and does all this. And so when we finally meet the fiance and he comes in here, Warren Cox, he's played by Stephen Collins. And you guys have seen Stephen Collins before. He's in a bunch of stuff for the Star Wars folks out there. He was Deckard in the 79 film, you know, the Star Wars, the motion picture.
Jason from the future here. Obviously, I meant Star Trek, not Star Wars. I was just testing you. Good job on catching that, listeners. Okay, back to the review.
He was in Tales of the Gold Monkey, for those that remember that.
Jason from the future again. If you like the idea of Tales of the Flying Monkey or would be interested in role-playing in that kind of universe, go over to the Decahedron RPG podcast. I'll put a link in the show notes. And as this is being released, there's been a series of episodes that just came out on that podcast where Joe, the host, has outlined how he would run Tales of Flying Monkey as a role-playing game. And he talks about his homebrew system he would use to run those adventures. It's pretty cool, and I highly recommend it. Okay, back over to our show.
If you haven't seen him recently, it's because in December 2014, he admitted to inappropriate sexual contact with three girls, you know, female minors, and he dropped out of the scene and hasn't done anything since 2014 when he admitted that. So, you know, he had a pretty busy career up to that point, but when the truth came out, that kind of killed his, rightfully so, killed his career. So,
yeah, that'll get you, man.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But anyway, Cox comes in. And he's like, oh, well, we're going to this charity. He's picking her up to take her to this charity dinner to ban contact sports.
Contact sports. Yep.
Yeah. And Monty's like, yeah, I can ban baseball. Sports. He goes, oh no, just football, ice hockey, basketball, the bad ones.
Mm-hmm.
So like, Monty gives
get
him
out
a
of here, Warren Cox.
Yeah. Monty gives him $100,000 a year. I want to donate. You know, and when we meet Cox, you know, Monty's like, here, have a drink. He's like, oh, no, I don't drink. He gives him the $100,000 donation. He's like, oh, I'll take a drink. And, you know, yeah, or not prestigious. What's the word I want? Pompous, kind of
pompous, preppy.
Yeah. And he's going around like critiquing the decorations in this hotel suite that they rented. And so Monty tells him, oh, I want to hire you to be my decorator. I'll give you $250,000 to redecorate the place. And, you know, he's, oh, I just know it from my ex-wife. Well, hire her. I'll give her $100,000, unless that's not enough. And, but anyway, so.
Right. Unless that be insulting.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. So, you know, and of course, Angela's angry at him for wanting to take this job, this decorating job, and falling prey to Monty's money that he's thrown at him. But, he takes the job. But when he goes to get permission from the lawyers, because he works for a law firm that is managing the money and is the Drake works for, the two heads there who are the ones trying to, you know, make Monty fail, they tell him what's going on, which they're not allowed to do. And they want him to, you know, keep tabs on him. And then later on, they encourage him to sabotage it so Monty would fail. And so throughout the movie, he's there and he's taking Monty's money, but he's also keeping tabs on him and reporting back to the bosses. And at one point he has a deposit for furniture that he keeps her seed, doesn't turn it in. And so there's this $20,000 that Monty doesn't know about that doesn't get spent at the end of the movie. You know, spoiler, but we already told you there's spoilers. The big thing Monty's working towards here, though, is he wants to, and we mentioned this already, he wants to have this ball game. And he wants to have a three-inning exposition with, or, yeah, that's how you say it, a three-inning game with the Yankees for his buddies, the Bulls, his minor league team, with himself as a pitcher. So, you know, they're setting that up throughout the movie. That's going to happen at the end of the movie, or at the end of the 30 days is when that game is. It's on the 29th day in the cycle. To announce this game to the law firm, he's looking for ways to spend money, and he's going around, and he hears about, you know, and his buddy, like Spike and Angela, are trying to get him not to waste his money. You know, they're angry at him whenever he wastes money, and he can't tell him why he's wasting money. But, you know, they try to get to talk to him about investments, and he hears about stamps. So he goes and he buys a stamp, and he buys a copy of the inverted Jenny, which is where it's got this biplane that's upside down on the stamp. And he uses that stamp to mail a postcard to the law firm, you know, about the ball game and all this stuff. And they're really happy when they see that he bought a stamp for $1.25 million, because that's an asset. But then when they see that he mailed it to him, then, you know, he doesn't have it anymore. It's no longer an asset. So the question is, as we pause, talk about the movie, did he break the rules with the stamp?
I would say yes. I would say that he breaks the rules, man. I that destroys the value of that stamp, don't you think?
Well, but he's using it the way it's meant to be used. I mean, if you buy a Rolls Royce and drive it off the lot, the value of it drops as soon as you drive it, right? As soon as you take a car and drive it off the lot, its value drops. But so the stamp still had value. Because you know, these collectible stamps, even if they're used, they still have value. They don't have as much. But he used it the way it's meant to be used. So, you know what I mean?
Yeah, but at that point, that stamp's not meant to be used that way. That'd be like using a Picasso for Walt.
Well, I think it's a little different, because the stamp is meant to be, like, if you say he went and bought collectible coins and used them as coins, would that be?
Yeah, it's a tough call, man. I mean, he doesn't destroy it. It's physically still there.
Right.
It's tough, dude.
Yeah, because I felt like
that sort of broke the rules.
Yeah. I mean, to be fair, it's a comedy, so the rules aren't as important in a movie like this, right?
What did you think?
I don't think it did, because he used it the way it's meant to be used.
Okay.
I kind of fall in there. Because it's like collectible coins. If you bought like a 50, I don't know. I'm not into collectible coins, but if you bought you bought like a sheet of those unissued quarters or whatever from whenever, you know, they sell those, or you see them at night, mm-hmm. late night, they're selling the coins on the gold coins or whatever. But if you bought those and used them to play video games with, I mean, you're using them, they're coins, you're spending them, right? I don't know. I think it skirts it. For the purpose of this movie, I'm okay going with it. For the movie. But it's an interesting question, definitely. So I don't know, were there other big spending things that we want to, I mean, obviously he does all kinds of crazy things, he spends money.
Yeah, one of the most iconic ones for me was when he invests in that dude's idea for the iceberg. He's going to go up to the North Pole and install some marine engines in the back of an iceberg and sail it down to the Middle East for all the Middle Eastern farmers. And Mrs. Drake and friggin' John Candy are both like, but there are no farmers in the Middle East. And Richard Pryor's like, but I don't think that's fair.
Right.
It's so good, dude. Oh man.
Yeah. Yep. Yeah. No, that was good. He goes, is $1 million enough? And he goes, well, yeah. And now that was one of the ones where he got money back from, though. That paid off. And then he did a bunch of bets, and the bets all paid off. and then he was back. He was like $10 million he made back. Throws him in.
Yeah. And then the bookie told him, he's like, you won all these long shots, you can't bet in this city anymore. because that's right. Like in the second half of the movie, they're starting to show the bad parts of all of this. That's when tensions are starting to run high.
Right. And again, that happened in the 45 one too, where, you know, he ended up things like there's a lot of betting in that one too, that where he won the bets and stuff. But so what does he do? Well, he sees a campaign ad. Or no, there's maybe a news expose about how crooked the politicians are or something like that. Or maybe it was the guy they hired. Anyway, somehow he hears this idea about nobody pays for their own political campaign. And there's a mayor race in New York. And he realizes this mayoral race, if he joins as a candidate, it's a great way to blow money on this political campaign. But he doesn't want to get elected, because if he's elected, then that counts as a job and it counts as an asset. So he can't win the race, but if he joins the race, he can blow millions of dollars running for mayor. And of course, both of the candidates are shown as scumbags and crooked and all this kind of stuff. So he runs on a ticket. Don't vote for me. Vote for none of the above. Don't vote for anybody in the election. And it's great. And he ends up trash talking, and the other guys meet, like, you know, they have a shady meeting at night on the, like, on the docks or somewhere. And, you know, they meet and they come up with this idea. They're going to both sue Brewster for slandering them, and which is great for him, because that means he has to pay them off, which is more money. And so he happily pays them $4 million each for, what did he call him? He called him, I forget what he called him, but there's a term, there's something.
The defamation. Yeah.
Wharf rats.
I forget, but he calls them wharf rats. Brewster learns about the mayoral election by watching a news story where the news says, we don't endorse either one of these candidates because they're both corrupt and are both trying to buy this election. So we don't endorse either one of them. And I was like, can you imagine the news today doing something like that? Being actually like moderate and in the middle and saying,
well, being honest. Yeah. I mean, yeah, I mean, I may go in November and write none of the above on the presidential election.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. There's some really good lines. Like, you know, at one point, Brewster's talking about it and he says, anyone can inherit $1 million and buy an election, but then they're going to want to steal it back with interest.
Right.
And it's just like, yeah, that's what politicians do, man.
Yep.
Get money out of politics. That's what Brewster's Millions is all about. That's right. One section, at least.
Yeah, and you know, it's great. And he ends up dropping out the last minute, and so he can't be elected. But at the end of the election, nobody is elected. It, you know, none of the above, I think, does win. So I guess, I don't know how that worked out, you know, real life. You know, I guess whoever was the mayor stayed the mayor until they had another election, maybe. But, you know, but it was a point, right? It was about the principle of it. And, yeah. Mm-hmm. Another thing happened where they were in a car. He was taking the accountant out to lunch, and he bought this, you know, $125,000 car, she said it was, a convertible. And they get in the car and they get rear-ended by a guy. And Bruce was like, no, you're hurt. I know you paid attention to this part, you know. The guy's like, yeah, you know, he's, are you okay? And he's like, the guy's like, no, I'm fine. You know, we can handle this out, insurance. And Brewster's like, no, we can't. You're hurt. You know, you have brain damage. You don't understand. And as soon as the guy hears he's Monty Brewster, he's like, oh, no, I can't feel my legs. And he goes, the man's going to be paralyzed.
Yeah.
And he's going to write him a $100,000 check to tell him to, you know, to pay his own medical expenses. And the guy's like, but I have two ex-wives. And he goes, well, how about $300,000? So it's funnier when you watch the movie than here, I'll say it. But anyhow, so we go through, we get to the ball game, and also there's anything. And they're remodeling, you know, he's paid Cox and his ex-wife to Marilyn to remodel the upstairs. And they're doing these crazy remodels. And Monty goes up there, goes, oh, it's pretty good, but it's not good enough, Marilyn. You can do better. I want to have a room I want to die in. Yeah, you know, he tells her, and I need you to reach deep, Marilyn. I want a room I could be happy to die in.
And, me too, man. Me too. Yeah. I want a room that I could die in. Dude, that'd be the shit. Yep. Oh, it's so good.
So they go and they play their match against the Yankees, and the Yankees win. And so we haven't talked about the coach for the team, and we probably should have. Oh,
how could we forget? How could we forget Lenny from Law and Order?
Right, yeah. Jerry Orbach, who played, like you say, Lenny, Law and Order. He's done tons of stuff over the years, of course. But he plays the coach of the Little League team, right? The coach of the Bulls, their minor league team. And he's great as the coach. He really is. He does a great job. And he ends up pulling, you know, this whole thing set up because Monty wanted to pitch. But they end up, you know, they're losing now, and he pulls Monty from the game like a good coach would do. But he's great in the movie. But anyway, Monty gets pulled, but that's okay. The Yankees win. And then he comes out and he gives this speech where, you know, he thanks the Yankees and he says, you know, anybody can inherit $1 million, but these guys are real athletes and they work hard and, you know, they deserve your respect, all this. And that's where he also announces that he isn't going to, you know, be mayor. That's where Roundfield, the executor of the will, kind of broke the rules because he's supposed to be neutral. But the executor told him, listen, if you get elected as mayor, he tells him running for candidate is a great way to blow the money. But if you get elected, that'll, you know, be an asset. So that's when Richard Pryor drops out of the race.
Mm-hmm.
But he blows all the money. At the end of the day, he's broke. He throws one last party that not that many people. We don't see very many people at the party. All of his buddies and friends and the people he's hired there, they take up a collection for him, but he won't take the money because, you know, we know because he can't have any money. They don't understand that. Next day, he wakes up.
But that was very touching.
Oh, it was. Yeah, definitely. Yeah. Well, everybody except the PI that found him in the first place, the Jake guy who was hired as a photographer. He didn't want to give him any money. Oh, you know what's great is where in the beginning they go to the restaurant, or not even at the restaurant, but when they're in the office of lawyers initially, when Monty's being told about the inheritance and so he hasn't been hired yet as a cameraman, but he's just the PI that went out and found him. And Spike already doesn't like him. And they sit down in the waiting room and there's one magazine there and this guy, the PI goes to reach for it and Spike grabs it away so he can't read it. And he just throws it on the table out of reach. 'Cause Spike does not like that guy at all.
No, does not.
So at the end of the day, he had rented like his tuxedos and his clothes and all that. So he gets woken up by the hotel manager. He's like, hey, it's checkout time. You got to go. And they take all his clothes. So he's in his old jeans and baseball jersey that, you know, he started the movie in. Goes to the law office. And right before he gets to go into the actual office, Cox comes back, the fiance who's working undercover for the corrupt lawyers. And he's like, here's this $20,000, your money back. You know, it's great. And of course, he knows that this is a problem because they had promised him a partnership if, you know, Monty had failed. And so he goes into the room and there's like 2 minutes left. He's like, I failed. There's just $20,000 left. And the executor is trying to encourage him to spend the money, not to give up yet. And Cox has to gloat to his fiance, to Drake, the accountant, about what happened. He said, I guess I can tell you now. And when she hears that, she bursts in the room, tells Monty not to sign, that he's being tricked by this. And probably that would have worked out okay just at that point. But, you know, because the executor probably would have investigated at that point, honestly. But we don't stop mm-hmm. there. And I forget the exact sequence. You remember the exact sequence, what happens?
Yeah, so he punches Cox, Brewster punches Cox, and then hires Drake to be his lawyer to represent him in the case, because Cox is like, I'm going to sue you, even though he doesn't have any money because he lost, theoretically, right? That in Cox's mind, he's lost. So he's like, I'm going to sue you forever, you broke dude. Like, that doesn't make any sense.
Yeah, because he tries to give him the $20,000, and Cox is like, I'm not going to take that. I'm going to sue you for everything you've got, which that's all he's got is that $20,000. He won't even have that at the end of the, in a minute. So it's, yeah. Mm-hmm. So that doesn't make a whole, but anyway, he gives that to her as a retainer. and she gives him her seat. So he has won the bet, and the executor still says he's going to investigate the law firm, and they're going to go down, and they're going to get sent to the showers. And yeah, that's the end of the movie. It just, you know, cuts off at that point.
Yeah, well, he gets $300 million.
What's that?
He gets $300 million.
Yeah, yeah, definitely. I mean, it's great. So two people we didn't mention there in the film. There's a reporter that keeps showing up, Chuck Fleming. He's played by Peter Jason. And you know, he's pretty great in there throughout the movie. That reporter, you've seen him before in a number of things. He's the bartender in 48 Hours. He's in Streets of Fire as well. So he's in a number of the Walter Hill movies. He's actually in Red Heat too. But you've seen him in other things. Oh, you know what? He was in Long Riders and The Driver too. Yeah, he's been in a ton of Walter Hill movies. But he's been in a bunch of stuff. But he's really great as a reporter. And he's kind of charting throughout the whole movie the different things that are happening. And then the other one we didn't mention, who only has a really small appearance here, is Rick Moranis is in here. And Rick Moranis is the guy that he's the, I forget how he bills himself, but he's basically, he repeats whatever you say. He says he's like one of those ex-Xerox machines. And so he's just, you know, whatever somebody says, he'll repeat it. And he's only there in the one scene doing that. But so we get a little bit of Rick Moranis in here too.
I did not realize that was Rick Moranis.
Yep. Yep. It was. So, Joe, what else do we have to say about Brewster's Millions?
I feel like we covered a lot. Well, so my question to you, would you take the deal or would you take the wimp clause?
No, I would take the deal. I think so. It's interesting. And maybe today it'd be a little bit different amount, right? But regardless of the amount, no, I would take the deal. But it'd be tough if you think about it. Having to spend the money, not have any assets, running for office was a good one. The 45 one where he bankrolls a play is another good one. Because he intentionally bankrolled a play he knew was going to fail was a thing. He didn't bankroll like a winning Broadway play. Like one of his other war buddies wanted, which is another reason that 45 movie is pretty progressive, is war buddy is Hispanic. And they play up like with the accent, like a Ricky Ricardo accent. But that's the only kind of thing in there. Like they don't, like he's not looked down on because he's Hispanic or anything. You know what I mean? So he intentionally bankrolled a losing play knowing it would fail. So there are ways to spend the money, but it would be tough though if you think about it. I mean, obviously in here, and I kind of wonder if he's not, you're pushing it with some of the salaries he's giving people too, right? So, because you got to wonder at some point where you're just giving money to somebody, $10,000 a week to a chauffeur or whatever, right?
Yeah, he pays a couple dudes like $100,000 a week.
Yeah, yeah, well, yeah, John Candy, what'd he give him? Like, I forget what he gave him, something crazy like that.
Yeah, because he makes him vice president. And so I think it's like, it might be like $150,000 for the month or something. It's something like that.
Yeah, it was. Although there may be vice presidents out there make that. I don't know,
but I'm sure there are.
Yeah. but still, some of the salaries I think might be pushing it. But yeah, I don't know. I would definitely go for it because what do you have to lose? You know, you start off with nothing. So if at the end of the month you don't have anything, then you haven't lost it. You just had a fun month. You know,
you had the most amazing month of your entire life.
Right.
And you're back right where you started.
Yeah. Cause the other thing you don't see in these, like you could be renting airplanes or you could be stuff like that. So yeah, I think there are ways to do it, but yeah, not telling people what you're doing is where it gets tough. Right. Because where you're not allowed to tell anybody is the tough part, because how long is it going to take somebody to try to commit you for, you know, being unbalanced, for blowing through all this money, right?
Yeah, put you under a conservatorship or something.
Yeah, which you have to wonder, obviously that doesn't happen in these movies, and you have to wonder how that would work out, because obviously the law firm would have to, they wouldn't have to, but you would think they would have to get involved at that point, right? Because
right.
Yeah, it's,
well, it's very hard to put somebody under conservatorship if you're just some random person.
Yeah, that's true. And it's not like this money, anybody else, you know, because he's the only living relative and he doesn't have any relatives, you know, there's nobody really in his family to go
right.
You know, try to stop him. But yeah, I would definitely, I don't know. What about you? Would you take the $1 million and the wimp clause or?
No, dude, I'd go for it, man. I think today it'd be really, really easy to do. 30 million in today, you could do that.
Well, it's a million month. A day, right? It's a million a day is what you have to spend.
You could do that in a couple weeks these days. Things are so expensive now. Like you said, you could rent airplanes, you know, you could friggin' rent crazy cars. You could fund a really crappy movie. You could spend $30 million on a movie.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, and if it bombs, you're done.
Right. Yeah. You can. So it's 150 grand is what you can gamble. And 150 grand is what you can give to charity.
Yeah. So you give away 10%, basically. You just cut off 10% and just go for it. Like, yeah, dude, I think it'd be pretty easy.
Yeah, even if you up the value of it, I think it'd be pretty easy to do. Yeah. You know, because you just, you know, maybe you have to rent a fleet of planes or trains or whatever you're renting, you know, to do it. But I think you could do it. But it's a fun premise. It's a fun movie. I think everybody does a good job in here.
Yeah.
You know, I laughed quite a bit in this rewatching it. I think it still stands up. It didn't do well at the box. Or no, I take that back. It didn't do good with the critics, but it did well with the box office.
Nice.
This is one of the Walter Hill movies that did make money. You know, most of his movies actually didn't make money, but this one actually did. So if you were going to watch this with like a double feature, what would you pair up with it?
I've been thinking about it, and I think I would go, because one thing I feel like it was missing, and I sort of touched on it before, was the bond he has with his co-star. So I think I would go with Hear No Evil, See No Evil, because to see Richard Pryor and Gene Wilder with their bond together, yeah, it's something to see. And, you know, I feel like they would just flow into each other really well. I mean, you could even see it, like he's an older guy, like, you know, a few years have passed. And so Brewster went blind. And so it's still the same universe. No, but I think I feel like that would be a fun combo to watch, to see, you know, Brewster's Millions and follow that up with Hear No Evil, See No Evil. What about you?
Yeah, I think that's a good combo, and that's actually funnier. So I don't know. I've got a couple things on the list. You know, I thought about what's another movie where it's got some similarities, and Easy Money came to mind. I don't know if you remember Easy Money from 83. Mm-hmm. It's a Rodney Dangerfield movie. This is another movie where you take this comedian and kind of tie his hands behind his back, right? Because this is a really conservative Rodney Dangerfield movie. I don't know if it was probably rated R. Not a lot of language, and it's not too bad. Oh, well, there's some F-bombs in it. But Joe Pesci, a really young Joe Pesci, is his buddy in this one. We see a really young Jennifer Jason Leigh in there, which is cool. Tom Noonan is one of his buddies, which is kind of cool to see him just as a comedic supporting role. Tom Noonan, of course, he's Frankenstein's monster in the Monster Squad. He plays the killer in Manhunter. He's in a bunch of things, but he's the Ripper in Last Action Hero. So in Easy Money, the idea is that his mother-in-law and him hate each other, and he's a baby photographer in this one. And Rodney Dangerfield is. And the mother-in-law dies, and she leaves him this department store worth all this money, but he's got to go for a whole year with clean living because, you know, he drinks and he smokes pot and he, you know, does all this stuff. So he can't smoke, he can't drink, he's got to lose weight. But we don't really get to that part till like halfway through the movie, and they miss a lot of opportunities. Like, we never see him going to AA or anything like that, which is kind of a shame. But the twist at the end of that one is, at the end of the time, she walks out onto the yacht where they're going to, you know, do the signing thing. And she just pretend to be dead. And she's not going to give him the money. She just wanted him to live better, but she like lets him, you know, move in with her and live in the mansion with her and stuff. And so at the end of that movie, him and his buddies have a little hideout in the basement and they're still down there, you know, smoking and playing cards and doing all the stuff. I kind of thought about that one, but you know, I'd almost be tempted to go with like Trading Places with this one too, mm-hmm. you know, not sharing the same actors, but you know, also we get that swap and a lot of commentary about money and finances and all that kind of thing in Trading Places too.
Yeah, right? I could see that for sure.
And Trading Places has, you know, the beginning gag in there. I don't know. Should we ruin Trading Places? You can't ruin Trading Places. The gag in there with no legs is one of my favorite. That I laugh every time I watch that clip.
Nice.
I don't know. Maybe that makes me a bad person, but.
You know. No, it doesn't.
But you're right. Like, yeah, Hear No Evil, See No Evil, Stir Crazy, Silver Streak. Any of the ones you do with Gene Wilder, you know, they all have great points. The toy.
And Hear No Evil. Oh, sorry.
No, go ahead.
And in Hear No Evil, See No Evil, there's also a bar fight. Richard Pryor gets in a bar fight in that movie. So you could compare his bar fighting skills from the two movies.
That's true. We don't see much of the bar fight in Brewster's Millions, though. It's like it starts you see drinks fly in the air, and then they're in jail. They didn't really shoot much of the bar fight, which is sad. It would have been good to see a little bit more of the bar fight. But yeah, so were there any other things that came to your mind with potential matchups or
the toy? Just to stick with Richard Pryor, but no, not really.
Yeah. So if we were going to bring this to the gaming table and we're going to play this as a game, is there any, and this is a tough one because, you know, our conflicts in this game are going to be more verbal conflicts and things that we tend to role play out as opposed to rolling dice for, but any ideas on what kind of system might work to bring this to the gaming table if you're going to do this?
Yeah. So I feel like it has to be a game with a wealth mechanic because you have to have some way to track his wealth other than completely abstract it. There has to be more to it because that's the crux of the game, right? Is you have to spend this money and you can't tell anybody. So I don't know. I was thinking even something like Cthulhu. They have a pretty decent wealth mechanic in there. It works pretty well. Like the rating system, the wealth rating system works pretty well for Call of Cthulhu. And, you know, there's Cthulhu Modern, so you could just use that. I think that would work.
It could work, and you'd have to tweak it. One thing I liked, you don't see as much in this one as you do in the 45 version, is the kind of stress that your main character Brewster's under to, you know, spend the money.
Sanity point.
Yeah. Yeah. You'd tweak it obviously, but you have the insanity rules and the sanity mechanic in Call of Cthulhu. I was thinking more like just go with the super light system that gets out of the way, you know, even something like a lasers and feelings based system, or even like, you know, it might work for this. Cause in all these, you tend to have like a buddy or somebody he's bouncing off of. You might be able to, you'd have to tweak the rules, but you might be able to do something like Double Trouble and modify that Double Trouble and modify the rules to do this as well. But something light like that where, because obviously character death isn't an issue. You're not worried about that. You know, you're not really worried about conflicts, like physical conflicts so much as, you know, playing out. And you just need a way to balance out situations. But yeah, Call of Cthulhu would be an easy answer that would definitely work. But yeah, it'd be interesting. I mean this wouldn't be like a long-term campaign, but doing this is like a one shot, like, you know, like a crazy way to do it might be interesting. One night trying to tweak the idea, you know.
Well, because you could look at the story from 1925 and get the numbers and then just use Cthulhu. You wouldn't even have to put it in the modern world. You have all the source books for how much stuff costs. and you have the wealth system in there and the sanity system in there, I feel like it's a home run.
Yeah. Yep. Yeah, because you're not going to touch most of them. You're not rolling that much. And when you do roll, it's just percentile rolls that you're rolling. So, and that has a system in there for opposed rolls as well. So if you're doing some kind of opposed roll, you can do it. So, yeah, I think that'd be a really good choice. I agree with you.
Jason from the future here. This was recorded a while ago, as I mentioned in the beginning. I would also add visceral to this. I think you could tweak it to work well for a game like this because the threats and challenges could be just stress related and don't have to be actual combat. You could tweak the system pretty easily to do that. And because it has failure with a cost or success with a cost, then you can have complications and things like that added in. So I think it would work pretty good. Anyhow, back to the episode.
Well, Joe, I really appreciate your coming on to talk about Brewster's Millions with me.
I really appreciate you having me on. Thank you. And this was super fun. Yeah, I love this movie. I'm so glad you put this together and were like, hey, let's watch Brewster's Millions. And I was like, that sounds like a really, really good idea. And it was. It was awesome.
Yeah, I hope everybody else out there, everybody listening has gone and watched it. Or if you haven't, go back and watch it. It's a fun movie. I think maybe kind of gets a bad rap. But it's just a movie to watch. You know, it's not a super deep movie, although there are some things in there about politics and about money and about greed and all in there. But I think this is also a movie you could kind of turn your brain off and just enjoy the laughs, enjoy the comedy in there. And so definitely recommended. So, okay, well, great. Well, Joe, take care, folks. You can find Joe over the Hindsightless podcast. So check that out. And I will be back soon. Until then, be excellent to each other.
Bye.
Who's on the phone? Who's on the phone? Who's on the phone? Who's on the phone? Maybe it's your auntie or a joke about your spouse, but the operator's screaming it's coming from inside the house. What's in the box? What's in the box? What's in the box? What's in the box? Well, the audience is pretty sure he took a pretty head, and the only question left is if I could shoot him dead. Bring on the gore, bring on the gore. I want some more, bring on the gore. Well, the butcher is a dustman and more. By the tipper, and I'm assuming that your partner back there in the wood chipper. Don't look away. Don't look away. Don't look away. Well, the zombies are arising and the world's gone to heck. We're living for the dying and we're dying for the train wreck.